She don't stand no cheating now, my babe. My babe, she don't stand no cheating now, my babe. My babe, she don't stand no cheating.
Frog and Matchett. Performing live today in WKAR's Studio S here in East Lansing. They are playing several times at this weekend's Old Towns Blues Fest, and you'll hear them throughout our show today on Current State. And what good is music if you don't talk about it? We'll chat these two up in just a little bit. Also on today's Current State, the Grand Rapids Art Prize is up and running again. We'll revisit that event, and deer hunting is back in Meridian Township this weekend, too, as efforts continue to cull the herd there. We'll talk to one hunter and Jane Greenway of the township. But first, Michigan has joined a small group of state and local governments in something of an experiment. The state's launching a program that will seek to attract private investors whose money will address very public problems. Social impact bonds are relatively new, first tried in England in just 2010, 3 years ago. Michigan just became the eighth state or municipal government to embark on such an initiative in the U.S. Backers say the bonds privatize risk, socialize benefits, and offer investors the chance to make a profit. To learn more, we welcome Joe Pavona, an advisor to Governor Rick Snyder on public-private partnerships. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Mark.
And on the phone, Jeff Liebman of Harvard's Kennedy School. Jeffrey runs the school's Social Impact Bond Lab, and he'll be working here in Michigan for a year to help get the program going. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
Jeff, tell us, just give us a good working definition of what social impact bonds are and how they work.
The social impact bonds are a new way for government to contract for social services. And the basic idea is the government writes a contract with service providers around a set of outcomes and impacts that the programs are supposed to have, and the government only pays if the programs actually work and produce those impacts.
Now, I think a lot of people understand how a commercial product or service makes money for an investor. Joe Pavona, how exactly might solving a social problem generate a profit for an investor? Where would that profit come from?
Mark, I think maybe the best way to look at that might be to use an example. And I'll use an example that I think is kind of straightforward. If we look at adult correctional recidivism, and we know that it's costing Michigan $35,000 or $40,000 to house a prisoner in our system. And if, for example, we choose a program target to reduce recidivism rate by 10%, and we meet those targets, then obviously we could calculate the savings that's occurring by these individuals not being in the correctional facility. And it's out of that annual savings per prisoner, that $35,000 or $40,000 annually, that a portion of that is then used to repay the investors.
Okay. Now, will that be, it's funny you should bring that one up, that is notoriously one of the state's most expensive jobs is the prison system. Is that one that you'll be looking at?
Certainly, Mark.
And how do you do that? How would you get a private investor involved in cutting those costs?
Well, I think right now we are in the process of what I like to call an information gathering stage. And we are looking at opportunities across a broad range of service areas. We've recently released a request for information to the broader market that we're looking for input to help us in this information gathering stage. And I think Jeff is fond for saying that we're looking for gold star service providers who are performing out there and already providing good service that can bring those ideas forward to us. And I think the other important aspect of this is many of the investors are philanthropics, and we certainly know that Michigan is a wonderful state. We have a wonderful philanthropic community that we believe are going to be interested in this type of program as it relates, I think, to their mission and their interest in improving our communities. So we think that philanthropics will be some of the primary investors. We think that this request for information is giving us an opportunity to dialogue with a broader community about what they think and where they believe that we can have success.
Jeff Liebman in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Social impact bonds are a very new thing, implemented first in 2010 in Britain, but there have been projects launched in Massachusetts and in New York. You've had a hand in those, as I understand it. How have those gone? Have they yielded a profit for society and for investors?
Well, it's certainly too early to tell about the outcomes, but I think the key thing about the investments being made here is in these kind of budget times, it's really hard to invest in prevention because budgets are tight, and spending money now that's going to save you money 5 years down the road is really challenging. And so even if you know that there's a really good nonprofit service provider, for example, providing job training and employment services to people who've recently been released from prison, and even if you know the right thing to do is to help them scale up their operations because doing so is going to yield better outcomes and save money, it's really hard to do in these kinds of when the budgets are so tight. And what this structure is allowing is really us to make some of these investments that we know we should be making, but that it's really hard to do through the regular budget process right now, given how tight the budgets are.
There's apparently some concern that a low-risk pilot program could be chosen that might favorably distort the results. What government controls will be put in place to ensure the proper measurement of outcomes, Jeff?
Well, I think what we've seen in the initial projects is that there's a very rigorous evaluation, not just a measurement of the outcomes, but an evaluation of the impact. And what I mean by that is one needs to not only be able to tell of the people who got the service what fraction of them, for example, returned to prison, you need to know what a measure of what would have happened if they hadn't gotten the service. And so you need some kind of control or comparison group that can be used to come up with an assessment of that. And what we've seen in Peterborough and in the UK, and what we've seen in New York City in the project that they started, and what we're seeing in the state projects that are getting off the ground, is a range of evaluation methodologies, but all ones that are going to generate statistically valid assessments of the impacts and allow us down the road to really make what the more fundamental decision is, after we've done this for 4 years, we have to know whether it worked or not and whether we should buy more of this or whether this is a program that doesn't work and we should stop spending money on it.
We're talking with Joe Pavona of the Governor's Office of the State of Michigan and with Jeff Liebman of Harvard University about social impact bonds just on the scene here in Michigan. This was just announced about 10 days or so ago. Joe, what public Michigan, you mentioned the prison system just a minute ago, an attempt to maybe target recidivism as something for a social impact bond. What other public Michigan problems have you thought most about while considering these social impact bonds?
I think that's one of the exciting things, Mark, is this is an innovative way to perhaps tackle some of our toughest social problems. And examples of that could be homelessness prevention. Another example might be early childhood development, juvenile justice, preventative health care, interventions for things like asthma and diabetes.
Can you sketch out one of those for us and how that might unfold?
Let's take early childhood development for a moment. Let's look, for example, that if we consider 3- and 4-year-olds, and there is now, I think, evidence coming forward that says that if we test reading skills for 3- and 4-year-old children, that we can predict the likelihood of them entering special ed in K through 12. And evidence is further showing that if there is a intervention, a social intervention, by providing quality daycare to those 3- and 4-year-olds who tested as being likely special ed students, the results is showing that there's a high likelihood in the 90-plus percentile range that these children will not enter special ed. And I think that's rather exciting news. And I think in terms of, I think, the Governor's Pathway to Success program and putting our children on a pathway, you know, for success. And so I think that might give our listeners some idea, Mark, in terms of how a particular project could unfold.
Jeff Liebman, how do private investors tend to respond when they hear about this approach? Are they enthused? Are they skeptical?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that the initial projects have been able to raise the investment dollars necessary to get off the ground. You know, we don't need every investor in America to be interested in this. We need enough who are interested either for financial reasons or for philanthropic reasons or somewhere in between who really see this as, because it's so data-driven and outcome-data-driven, they might see this as a better way to do their philanthropy than they've been doing it. We need enough to be able to finance these projects, and so far the projects that have been set up have been able to find investors. You know, I think the big question about this method going forward, it looks like the next 5 or 10 deals, there's going to be enough investor interest to get them done. But suppose those work, will there be enough investor interest, you know, for us to have 100 of these and $500 million of these of these investments out there? And I think that's the big unanswered question about this approach, that we're basically running the experiment to find out.
I do want to revisit this one idea, though. How do you guard against the profit motive and its capacity to seek out the path of least resistance, especially when it might not be the best solution for the problem you're seeking to address? Joe, have you thought about that?
Well, I think we have thought about it, and I might say that's one of the reasons that we have Professor Liebman with us to help guide us, I think, as we enter this for the first time. One of the things that we have learned, actually, in working with Jeff, is that there's a lower limit of success where there's no payment that will be made, and it's from that lower limit upward that investors get paid. And I think part of that is to help guard against, I think, the very point that you're trying to make, Mark, that just the early pickings aren't just there for grabbing, so that there is kind of this false impression of success. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Jeff Liebman, care to add anything to that?
I think there are two things that are really important in order to protect taxpayers in these projects. The first is, in choosing how much the government is going to pay for each outcome, you have to do a really rigorous assessment of what are the real savings if, for example, we reduce the number of children in special ed, or what are the real savings if you reduce the number of prisoners. And you have to do that calculation right, because if you use the wrong number and pay too much, you wouldn't be taking good care of the taxpayers. But secondly, what you have to do is hold the service providers responsible for serving a pre-specified group of people. Let's say all 1,000 people who come out of the juvenile justice system this year, you don't give them the choice of which 100 they want to serve, because you don't want to just allow them to serve the easy ones who are going to succeed anyway and take credit for that. And so it's by defining the population up front, in combination with being very careful about how you figure out the payment rate for different outcomes, that you end up protecting taxpayers in these projects.
I see. Very interesting. That was Jeffrey Liebman of Harvard's Kennedy School. Jeff runs the school's Social Impact Bond Lab, and he'll be working here in Michigan for a year to help get Michigan's Social Impact Bond Program working. Joe Pavone is an advisor to Governor Rick Snyder on public-private partnerships. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Mark.
Have a good day.
I don't know where to scratch. Well, now, come on, baby. Scratch my back. Say, I know you can do it. So come on, baby. Or get to it. Y'all smoking. But that feels so good.
Frog and Matchett here in Studio S. Here on our Friday edition of Current State, we'll be talking with these two great musicians coming up in just a little bit. They're performing several times at the Old Town Blues Fest this weekend. I'm Mark Bayshore. The early deer hunting season begins this weekend in Michigan. Now, statewide bow hunting is still almost 2 weeks away, and firearms hunting is permitted starting in mid-November. Meridian Township is one of a number of mid-Michigan communities facing an overpopulation of white-tailed deer. For many residents, they're a nuisance that sometimes inflicts minor property damage, but they pose a more serious threat to drivers on local roads. Tomorrow, in Meridian Township, they conduct their third annual deer harvest, a program that allows pre-approved hunters to help control the herd at specific locations. We're joined this morning by Jane Greenway, the Parks and Land Management Coordinator for the township. Hi, Jane.
Good morning.
And we're also here with Max Miller, a Hazlitt resident who's participating in the hunt. He's also a licensed nuisance control operator here in Michigan. Hi, Max.
Good morning.
Thanks to both of you for coming in. How many deer, do we know how many deer are in Meridian Township?
We don't have an exact number, but we know there's far too many.
Okay. What are the most common complaints from residents, Jane?
Car accidents, mostly, and then the deer eating people's geraniums and hostas.
Okay. This year, it's not uncommon to see a dead deer carcass by the side of the road in Meridian Township, regrettably. This year, there are more than 20 designated hunting sites. Can you tell us how those sites are chosen?
Sure. We took our maps and our GIS information and looked at all of the township-owned property. We have almost 2,000 acres of parks and land preserves, and we have placed hunters in virtually any township-owned property that we can that's large enough to hunt. And in addition, we are also hunting in one of the large county parks this year. So we're about expanding as large as we can.
Okay. Max Miller, you come to this from an interesting perspective. You're not just a bow hunter, but you're also a licensed nuisance control operator in Michigan. What's your angle on this problem in Meridian Township?
Well, the biggest question I get from residents is, what do I do to get rid of the deer that are foraging on my plants and vegetation? And the answer to that is about the only thing you can do is plant deer-resistant vegetation. And the problem is that vegetation that's deer resistant today, by tomorrow it may not be, because deer, they will forage on anything that they can to survive.
This is the third year for the township's deer harvest. What went well the first two times? What have you learned that maybe didn't go so well the first two times, Jane?
Well, really, it's gone off very well, and other people who have helped manage these programs throughout the state have said you guys are doing a great job, and you know we've been recommended by the DNR as a model that other local communities should follow. So no big complaints, no big problems really. The biggest surprise about this whole thing is the support. We didn't expect that from the community. We thought we'd have a lot more anti-hunting situations, and we mm-hmm. haven't seen much of that at all.
Have you participated in previous hunts, Max?
I have.
Okay.
And I would say that residents of the community are very polarized around this issue. You're either very much in favor of it or you do not favor it. There's very little middle of the ground.
Middle of the road.
Middle
yeah.
of the road, yeah.
yeah.
The other thing that I would say about it is white-tailed deer have only two natural predators. One is human, the other one is starvation. And we certainly don't want to have, as a sports person, we don't want to have a situation where we have deer like you see alongside the road that are struck by a vehicle or that are dying of starvation. Mm-hmm. We do not want to see that.
Now, Jane, Max suggested that there is some resistance to this, but you said the response has been generally positive. That seems to suggest There are polarized views, but the people who support it outnumber the people who don't. Is that what we take away from that?
Yes, they sure are. Some people just don't agree with hunting. They think that hunting is barbaric. They think that that we cause this problem by putting in more subdivisions and developing these very fragmented vegetated areas. So there's a lot going on here, certainly, but the bottom line is there's too many deer.
What happens to the deer once they're taken?
Well, the hunters take them to the processor. The majority of the deer are donated to the local food banks. So that kind of softens the whole issue, is that we're providing the church food banks a lot of venison, okay. And that's very appreciated.
We spoke with one well-known local deer processor in the area, Lynn Marendorf, owns Marendorf Meats in Mason. He's gearing up for the season. Lynn says his shop receives between 800 and 1,000 deer each year from customers wanting to cook venison, and we asked Lynn Marendorf if he's noticing a decline in the quality of animals coming into his shop.
In some areas, I mean, last year was a really good year. We had a lot of bucks brought in, and there was a lot of big ones. I mean, it's just, the thing is there's some of the deer that are real small, which I don't know. I'm not a biologist, so I just go by with what I see coming in. I mean, I'd like to see people try to shoot the bigger ones instead of trying to shoot the littler ones, but that's when you're out hunting, they all look big.
Max Miller, you alluded to some deer that are undernourished.
Yes.
Is that noticeable to you when you're out in the field?
Yeah, very much so. Any hunter will be able to identify a deer that's in good shape and one that is maybe diseased or undernourished. And a hunter is always torn between what do I do here? Do I look for that trophy animal, or do I take that animal that's underfed that really needs to be harvested? And so that becomes an issue.
Jane, you alluded a minute ago to the way the township is set up, the way it's structured, the way the sections of the township are set up. Does the township board play a role, a zoning kind of role here, in terms of impacting the deer population in the township? I would think they would.
In a sense, especially, you know, we have these park millages, a land preservation millage that acquires natural areas, forests, wetlands, things like that. So the town, you know, those have been township initiatives. And as a result, we might have areas that were hunted 10 years ago, but nobody's been hunting them for 7 years. So we have, you know, what do? We have a lot of wildlife in this area and a lot of neighbors living along those edges of those woods.
But is zoning a topic on the board as it impacts the deer population?
No, not really.
It's not?
No.
Okay. What can people do to make their yards less attractive to deer, Max?
Well, one of the things they can do is consult with a horticulturist that can help them understand what the deer-resistant vegetation would be. But again, deer-resistant vegetation today, next year, may not be deer-resistant depending
right.
on the population, so you have to be careful with that.
The next township-sponsored deer hunt runs much longer, from October 1st through January 1st. Jane, will the parameters be the same as they are this coming weekend? Then
they will. This weekend is the early antlerless season, so just 2 days. And then the traditional bow season in Michigan is always October 1st through January 1st. And we're taking advantage of every day of that open season. When we began the program 3 years ago, it was much smaller, 12 properties. You could only hunt a couple days a week. And then we figured out what we were doing a little bit more each year. And now we've greatly expanded the program. But our parks and land preserves are not just open to generalized hunting. This is a highly managed program where we select hunters, we qualify them. There's proficiency testing. We do background checks. So we're not just putting anybody out in our woods. These are our neighbors. They're all township residents who are familiar with these parks and land preserves, and as a result, they're likely to take more deer.
We've got 30 seconds here. Have you had much contact with other nearby townships or municipalities with regard to the success of your program? Are you exchanging information with your neighbors?
Yes, I get called on probably a weekly basis. Ann Arbor, Lansing, places on the west side of the state all want our deer management plan, and I give them everything and say, don't reinvent the wheel, just use ours.
Yeah. Jane Greenway is the Parks and Land Management Coordinator for the Meridian Township. We also thank Max Miller, a Hazlet resident who's participating in this weekend's hunt in Meridian. He's also a licensed nuisance control operator here in Michigan. Jane and Max, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hiding, peeping, hiding, running, hiding anywhere you want me to go. Yeah. Got me do what you want, baby, what you want me to do. Got me up, down, up, down, down, up, anywhere you want me to go. Yeah. Got me do what you want, baby, what you want me to do.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Frog and Matchett, who will chat up here in just a few minutes. They're performing at the Old Town Blues Fest this weekend. Art Prize has become a major event in Grand Rapids with thousands of visitors from all over the world. The huge pot of prize money available has a lot to do with why so many artists enter their works. Now underway, the two-week run of Art Prize will end October 4th with an award ceremony. Christian Gaines is in his first year as executive director of Art Prize, coming from a background in staging international film festivals. He told Current State Scott Pohl that he hasn't attended Art Prize in the past, and he's somewhat proud of that.
I'm so excited by how excited people are about the event itself. And when I say that I haven't been, it kind of renews their intentions in making sure that I understand how extraordinary a phenomenon it is.
I love the phrase in the press releases related to Art Prize that describe the entire setup as radically open international art competition.
That's right. Yep. Yes, there are a few basic tenets of Art Prize, and the idea is to make sure that the model, that the Art Prize platform itself, is as simple and as streamlined as possible, which is a challenge because it's unique. There's nothing else kind of really like it. But part of those tenets is that it is radically open. That is, anyone can be an artist and anyone can submit. And that it is independently organized. That is, artists submit, venues submit, and then there's a connections process. And what grows out of that process is kind of independent, certainly to us. And then that there's a public voting process. So, you know, anyone can vote and anyone can join in the conversation about the art that they like, that they want to support.
I want to go over a few of the stats. It's my understanding that the entries this year came to over 1,500 from 47 countries and 45 states. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Well, first question then, I guess, would be, how did we miss out on the other five states?
That's a good question. We'll have to zero in on them next year and see if we can't get all 50.
To your knowledge, how does that compare with years past? I have to think it's been growing with that kind of prize money at stake.
It has been growing. Certainly, it's grown internationally. About 10% of our of all of the entries that are exhibiting this year come from outside of the United States. And it's certainly our intention to continue to sort of geographically diversify the event as much as possible by making sure that as many arts communities in as many states and indeed in as many countries are aware of Art Prize and the opportunity not just to win a public voting prize or a jury prize, but also the opportunity of having your work seen by hundreds of thousands of renewing and new lovers, appreciators of art, and have your work exposed in that way, and to just sort of be a part of this massive community of artists and art professionals and kind of reaping the benefits of kind of expanding your professional network.
It's described as the world's largest art prize with $560,000 in prize money available. And I want to ask you about the funding mechanism for paying for all of this. Where's the money come from?
Sure. Well, we have over 140 sponsors. And the West Michigan tradition of corporate sponsorship and public and private foundations is it's a well told and deservedly told story. So we have a strong lineup of public and private foundations, of corporate sponsors, both local and national, who support the program. We also have individual givers, and we have a membership program that just started this year. So it's, just like any other nonprofit, just like any other 501c3, we work hard to make sure that we replace the money that we spend. That's what we do.
Lots of people like you will be attending for the first time, I assume. What sort of advice do you have for people who haven't been to Art Prize, the best way to get the most out of a visit?
Sure. Well, I think one of the best things to do is, if you're new in town, is to show up at the Hub at 41 Sheldon, which is sort of the official headquarters. And from there, it's very easy to get oriented. There's a lot of information. There's a lot of guides here who can help you on your way and get you oriented. You can pick up an event guide, and you can sort of get going that way. There's a lot of suggestions for walking trails around the city. There's a lot of suggestions for other ways to be able to experience the event itself. The other thing that's really important is to download the mobile app onto either your iPhone or your Android smartphone, and to experience Art Prize that way. There's a lot of information there. There's a lot of ways to be able to kind of look at the different kinds of art and be able to map out your route around the city. And then, of course, it's the best way to register and vote. And, voting is, I think, really central to the overall Art Prize experience, because it is easy to do, and artists love it and depend on it. And it's a lot of fun.
I wanted to ask you about the public vote. The first place prize money from the public vote part of the competition is $200,000. So everybody who goes gets to help pick the winner. How does that all work?
Sure. Well, you actually hit the nail on the head there. You can participate if you're over 16 years of age and you register either with a computer or with your smartphone within the 3-square-mile boundary of Art Prize. You have to be here and you have to be registered as a participant of Art Prize. Then you're eligible to vote. And you can go around to all the various venues. There's about 160 venues, and you can look at the art and you can choose what work you want to vote on. You can only vote once, and you can only vote if you're actually here participating in the event.
You can only vote once out of all the pieces that have been submitted?
No, you can vote on different pieces that you'd like to see win, but you can only vote once per piece.
Ah, and then there's a second phase after you've
narrowed
it down to something like 10 finalists, right?
That's right. We get to the top 10 date, which is September 29th. And then after that, there's a top 10 that's announced. All of those top 10 finalists actually win an award. And then all the voting goes back down to zero again, and then everyone votes on those top 10.
I suppose that voting mechanism is designed to prevent ballot stuffing from all over the world.
Well, you can't really vote from all over the world because it's geo-targeted. So that means that your smartphone is within a 3-square-mile boundary of where all of the art is, and it is only within that boundary, if you are registered within that boundary, that you can vote. So, for example, artists who might have a cadre of fans, friends, and followers can't simply put out an open call on the internet and ask their friends to vote on their piece, because that won't work.
Tell me about the juried prizes and how that system works.
Sure. There are three jurors. this year, and they're charged with a $100,000 grand jury prize. And then there's also jurors in other individual categories, each of which are worth $25,000.
So the public vote prize is bigger than the juried prize.
It is.
Interesting. What sorts of attendance expectations do you have?
Well, last year we welcomed about 400,000 people to Grand Rapids to experience Art Prize. This year, because of sort of increased awareness and publicity, including a Time Magazine award, Time Magazine article that named us one of five, one of the world's five festive events you won't want to miss in 2013, we're expecting closer to 500,000 people.
It's really amazing that it's reached this kind of scope in just its fifth year.
It's totally nuts. It really is. It's great. I mean, I think that you know, there's a real need for this kind of an event. I think that part of its appeal is that, you know, is that we utilize technology in a kind of an elegant and efficient way that really enhances and adds to the overall physical experience of being a part of Art Prize and walking around the city and kind of yielding to the experience of looking at art. And that's something that people, you know, really enjoy. I think that there's an element of discovering art. There's an element of art and its place in the city. You know, because you're kind of looking around, not just inside, you know, the big museums here like the Graham or the UICA or other venues like that, but there's also a lot of public art in public parks, on bridges, in the middle of the river, all, you know, on the sides of walls, murals, all kinds of things that people are kind of looking around and kind of yielding to the experience. And I think that that's part of the ultimate appeal, which is, you know, it's not just art, but where it is and why it's there and what it says about cities. And I think that that really strikes a chord. I think that really strikes a chord with people. And it's a great thing to do. It's a great thing to do with your friends. It's a great thing to do with your whole family. It's a celebration. It really is. It's a celebration of creative expression. It's a celebration of the courage that it takes to become an artist. It's a celebration of the courage that it takes to put your work out there and have people look at it. You know, I think it's just sort of very cathartic, whether you're whether you're an attendee, a participant, or whether you're an artist.
Christian Gaines is executive director of Art Prize. Good luck. You have a couple of busy weeks coming up.
I do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Matchett and Frog here on Current State. We'll be talking with these two great players coming up in just a little bit about their appearance tomorrow night at the Old Town Blues Fest. The Blues Fest is back. I'm Mark Bayshore. East Lansing organizers now say $33,000 have been raised for cancer research and a spur-of-the-moment campaign triggered by a very visible prank. Few people in the East Lansing and Ann Arbor areas haven't learned about the enormous gold blue that appeared as sky riding last Saturday over Spartan Stadium, and many of those same people have learned how one MSU official responded quite creatively. Scott Westerman, the executive director of the MSU Alumni Association, figured whatever it cost the U of M athletic department to pay for the sky riding, at a minimum, ought to be generated for a nobler cause. And as the spouse of a two-time cancer survivor, Westerman appealed to Spartans for donations to ovarian cancer research. $33,000 later, we welcome Scott Westerman back to Current State. Hi, Scott.
Good morning from Jacksonville, Florida, Mark.
Hey, nice to have you on board. What do you make overall of the response to this campaign?
You know, I think this is really a watershed moment for Spartans, because there were two ways we could have responded to this, Mark. I mean, one way is in the normal kind of sports, amping up the negative rhetoric that just kind of goes on in athletics nowadays. But the way that the Spartan Nation responded totally blew my mind. You know, I made this small suggestion from the backseat of a taxi cab in Washington, D.C., as I was driving to an alumni scholarship event, that we might want to try and channel some of this towards ovarian cancer awareness. This is Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month, and the Michigan Ovarian Cancer Alliance is located in Ann Arbor. So I thought, how fitting would it be if Spartans contributed to that great small organization? And the rest is history.
I'm sure you're really gratified by the cash raised, but what kinds of verbal responses have you heard most during this campaign?
I think that the common thread is that Spartan alumni are proud to be Spartans as a result of what happened. I mean, this has just showed total class in the Spartan Nation, and I think everybody's feeling pretty good about being green-blooded these days.
Have you heard from many Wolverine fans who got on board, though, too?
Well, you know, and that is the interesting thing, Mark, because I think what's happened now is we've elevated the conversation beyond just this important understanding and awareness of what a deadly disease ovarian cancer is to the broader issue, which is the quality of education and the importance that an educated workforce has to Michigan. And when you look at Michigan and Michigan State, we graduate more CEOs, more great leaders, more educated, talented people that stay in the state of Michigan, just about, well, than anybody else in the state. So together, we're a powerful force for good. So we have to think of this rivalry like this. Ignorance and poverty are our enemies, not one another.
I have to ask what you make of the disclosure yesterday that the money for the skywriting came from U of M athletics.
Well, you know, I got to say I'm grateful to Dave Brandon for doing it, because unknowingly he became the catalyst for the Spartan Nation to pull together as we really never have before. I mean, we had over 1,000 donations, but if you look at what happened across social media, across the national press, I was stunned to see ESPN, CBS, and ABC all covering this story and talking about how wonderful it was that Michigan State had turned what could be a negative into a very positive thing, not just for our institution, but for a very noble cause.
We do want to make clear, too, that the money that paid for the skywriting was not public money. It comes from boosters and donors in the U of M athletic department. You have helped to fuel what I imagine has become the most publicized rivalry caper yet between MSU and U of M. It'll be hard to top this.
Well, you know, it is interesting, because we literally had donations from as far away as Beijing and Mumbai.
Wow.
Colleen and I have been invited to be on television here in Jacksonville this morning to talk about it, and we got a donation from the Space Coast Spartan. So this story has really gone viral in every positive sense of the word.
$33,392 so far. Scott Westerman is Executive Director of the MSU Alumni Association. Thanks, Scott. See you soon.
Great to be with you.
Matchett and Frog here live in Studio S on Current State at 90.5 WKAR. This weekend, blues like you just heard will flow like water through the streets of Lansing's, like muddy water through the streets of Lansing's Old Town. Ooh, did he really say that? As performers from around the U.S. will take the stage at Old Town's Blues Fest, one of the acts playing this weekend is Matchett and Frog, who you've been hearing playing throughout today's show. We're also joined by Holly Equagenor Etchy, Administrative Manager of MICA, the Michigan Institute for Contemporary Art. Welcome, one and all. Good to see you.
Hey, Scott. Hey, Mark.
Yeah, Frog and Dave Matchett, you both play in larger groups. What's it like to play in this stripped down instrumentation here, just the two of you?
It's exactly that. You get to explore the song from like
the root level of the music. And
bare bones.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, there's a chance for a little bit more expression, a little bit more dynamics. That kind of thing goes on more in just a two-person thing.
Sure. Frog, you've been at Elderly for a long time, Elderly Instruments in downtown Lansing. Where's the larger Lansing music scene at right now, in your opinion?
Well, certainly, you know, those of us that are old enough to remember what the music scene was like in the mid-70s when the drinking age was 18, you know, it's a whole different thing. But, you know, there are lots of places for people to play, and certainly I think a lot of people in Lansing understand how good just the quality of the musicianship is around this town. Absolutely. Some people don't. Some people, I think, take it for granted, really. But there are just a number of really fine players in this town. And, you know, some of it has to do with the fact that the school's here. But I think, that good players attract good players. The guys that I play with an organization in Detroit, when they come into town and maybe we do something with several other acts, they're just, you know, gee, there's nothing like this in Detroit. There's nothing like this in Detroit, and they're talking about Lansing.
Wow. So. Holly Equagenor Etchie, tell us, give us the rundown of the Old Town Blues Fest, not the act-by-act thing, but just tell us about the larger event. How many different performers will be taking the stage this weekend?
We have an array of performers. It's going to be an eclectic mix of blues. I don't have the exact number of performers that we'll be having, but the festivities kick off at 4 p.m. on Friday the 20th and then pick up again at 1 p.m. on Saturday. And we also have a kids area on Saturday, 1 to 7 p.m., and we'll have some kids acts on our Micah stage, and also a happy hour from 4 to 6 p.m. We can get into our turnaround lounge for free. So those are some of the highlights.
How long have you been playing harp, Dave?
Well, ever since I went to Western Michigan University, and I started doing that in the 70s.
Your harp program at Western is renowned.
Right.
Oh,
that's it.
Well,
I was
a music major there, and I got a little tired of practicing my euphonium, and I would take a harmonica.
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
You played the euphonium?
Absolutely.
Okay, wow, that is quite a transition.
And then I used to take my harmonica into the stairwell in the dorm because the natural reverb in there was amazing.
Stairwells and bathrooms.
Yes,
it was great.
So I would sit in the stairwell and I'd play for hours and hours, and I've been playing ever since.
How long have you two known each other?
Well,
a really long time.
More than we cared even think
about.
More than 20 years.
Oh, my God. That's an eternity.
I also work at Elderly Instruments. I'm their photographer and graphics designer. And Frog and I have worked there. I think I've worked there for 16, 17 years, something like that.
So, you can only imagine the number of collaborations that have been hatched at Elderly Instruments alone, from all over the state, probably all over the country.
It's true, and in all kinds, all different forms of music, everything from folk music to heavy metal music. There's collaborations that go on there.
Yeah. How long have you been a player, Frog?
Well, I've been working.
I'll get
steady sharp. Since 1970. So there you go.
Okay, do the math. Are you guys going to record, or are you strictly a live act at this point?
It's so new to us. Only a few months. We're only a few months
old.
You're
so bright.
You know,
that's how Crosby, Stills, and Nash got their record deal, though. You know, they're jamming around Mama Cass's kitchen table, and the next thing you know, they're super group, superstars.
Well, you know, we're just exploring it. We're trying to figure it out. I'm sure there's a possibility that we'll do that.
Holly, tell us a little bit more about your organization, MICA.
So MICA is a nonprofit arts organization out of Old Town, and it's been through a few different evolutions in terms of its name. But just a few years ago, it became MICA Gallery, and the organization this year became officially known as MICA Across the Board. And it is we have MICA Gallery down in Old Town that opened up a few years ago. And then we do the Lansing Jazz Fest, produce the Michigan Mosaic Music Festival, and also then the Old Town Blues Fest.
Okay. And Dave, I couldn't help but notice, I never would have guessed that you have as many harps as you do, but you've got like a briefcase, a large briefcase that's full
He's
of
armed.
These harps. How many do you own?
He's armed.
Well, You know, I own a lot of them. I own more than this here. This is what I need.
Oh, good.
Rather
great.
Than
well, there's
what I want.
There's two dozen in, just in your bag, probably.
Exactly. There's probably 26 or 7 that I use that are in there. And then there's a couple duplicates because harmonicas notoriously will go flat or jam up or something like that.
Okay.
So some of them you have to kind of get one real quick.
Okay. Well, we've enjoyed the music an awful lot today. We want to thank our three guests, Holly Equagenor Etchy of Mica, along with Matchett and Frog, who will be performing tomorrow night at 6 p.m. at the Old Town Blues Festival, one of many acts that you can enjoy down there. We hope you take advantage of that. Holly, thanks for coming in. Dave and Frog, all the best. Break a leg. That's our show for today. Coming up next week on Current State, we conclude our Detroit Water Renaissance series with a look at efforts to clean up the Rouge River. Also, we recap Spartan football with the Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexroad. All of that and more Monday on Current State. Our executive producer here at Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry and to Aaron Young for engineering. Matchett and Frog are going to take us out here today. Matchett and Frog, veterans of the Lansing music scene, again, 6 p.m. tomorrow night at the Old Town Blues Festival. It's been fun. I'm Mark Bayshore, and you've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Better help me, 'cause I can't do it by myself. Yeah, you better help me, 'cause I can't do it by myself. And if you won't help me, baby, I'm gonna find me someone else. And when I walk, you walk with me. And when I talk, baby, you better talk to me, yeah. You better help me, 'cause I can't do it by myself. And if you won't help me, baby, I'm gonna find me someone else.